Write down your 5 most stubborn positions and see if you can soften them.
The first time I tried this strategy, I was so stubborn that I insisted that I wasn't stubborn. Over time, as I have worked toward becoming a gentler person, I have found it far easier to see where I'm being stubborn. Here are a few examples from my clients. People who aren't stressed are lazy. My way is the only way. Men aren't good listeners. Women spend too much money. Children are too much work. People in business don't care about anything except money. You can see that the list itself is potentially endless. The point here isn't the specifics of what you are stubborn about, but rather the fact that you hold on so tightly to any given idea you might have. It doesn't make you weak to soften your positions. In fact, it makes you stronger. I have a male client who was adamant, to the point of being obnoxious about it, that his wife spent too much money. As he relaxed a little and noticed his own rigidity, he discovered something that he's now a little embarrassed about, but laughs at. He found out that, in reality, he spent more discretionary money on himself than his wife spent on herself. His objectivity had become muddled by his own rigid belief. As he has become wiser and gentler, his marriage has improved immensely. Rather than resenting his wife for something she wasn't even doing, he now appreciates her restraint. She, in turn, feels his new acceptance and appreciation and loves him more than before.
Just for fun, agree with criticism directed toward you. Then watch it go away.
So often we are immobilized by the slightest criticism. We treat it like an emergency and defend ourselves as if we were in a battle. In truth, however, criticism is nothing more than an observation by another person about us, our actions, or the way we think about something that doesn't match the vision we have of ourselves. Big deal. When we react to criticism with a knee-jerk, defensive response, it hurts. We feel attacked, and we have a need to defend or to offer a counter-criticism. We fill our minds with angry or hurtful thoughts directed at ourselves or at the person who is being critical. All this reaction takes an enormous amount of mental energy. An incredibly useful exercise is to agree with criticism directed toward you. I'm not talking about turning into a doormat or ruining your self-esteem by believing all negativity that comes in your direction. I'm only suggesting that there are many times when simply agreeing with criticism diffuses the situation, satisfies a person's need to express a point of view, offers you a chance to learn something about yourself by seeing a grain of truth in another position, and perhaps most important, provides you an opportunity to remain calm. One of the first times I consciously agreed with criticism directed toward me was many years ago when my wife said to me, "Sometimes you talk too much." I remember feeling momentarily hurt before deciding to agree. I responded by saying, "You're right, I do talk too much sometimes." I discovered something that changed my life. In agreeing with her, I was able to see that she had a good point. I often do talk too much. What's more, my non-defensive reaction helped her to relax. A few minutes later, she said, "You know, you're sure easy to talk to." I doubt she would have said that had I become angry at her observation. I've since learned that reacting to criticism never makes the criticism go away. In fact, negative reactions to criticism often convince the person doing the criticizing that they are accurate in their assessment of you. Give this strategy a try. I think you'll discover that agreeing with an occasional criticism has more value than it costs.
See the glass as already broken, and everything else too.
This is a Buddhist teaching that I learned over 20 years ago. It has provided me, again and again, with greatly needed perspective to guide me toward my goal of a more accepting self. The essence of this teaching is that all of life is in a constant state of change. Everything has a beginning, and everything has an end. Every tree begins with a seed and will eventually transform back into earth. Every rock is formed, and every rock will vanish. In our modern world, this means that every car, every machine, every piece of clothing is created, and all will wear out and crumble. It's only a matter of when. Our bodies are born, and they will die. A glass is created and will eventually break. There is peace to be found in this teaching. When you expect something to break, you're not surprised or disappointed when it does. Instead of becoming immobilized when something is destroyed, you feel grateful for the time you had. The easiest place to start is with the simple things, a glass of water, for example. Pull out your favorite drinking glass. Take a moment to look at it and appreciate its beauty and all it does for you. Now, imagine that same glass as already broken, shattered all over the floor. try to maintain the perspective that, in time, everything disintegrates and returns to its initial form. Obviously, no one wants their favorite drinking glass or anything else to be broken. This philosophy is not a prescription for becoming passive or apathetic, but for making peace with the way things are. When your drinking glass does break, this philosophy allows you to maintain your perspective. Rather than thinking, "Oh my God," you'll find yourself thinking, "Ah, there it goes." Play with this awareness and you'll find yourself not only keeping your cool, but appreciating life as never before.
Be grateful when you're feeling good and graceful when you're feeling bad.
The happiest person on earth isn't always happy. In fact, the happiest people all have their fair share of low moods, problems, disappointments, and heartache. Often, the difference between a person who is happy and someone who is unhappy isn't how often they get low, or even how low they drop, but instead, it's what they do with their low moods. How do they relate to their changing feelings? Most people have it backward. When they are feeling down, they roll up their sleeves and get to work. They take their low moods very seriously and try to figure out and analyze what's wrong. They try to force themselves out of their low state, which tends to compound the problem rather than solve it. When you observe peaceful, relaxed people, you find that when they are feeling good, they are very grateful. They understand that both positive and negative feelings come and go, and that there will come a time when they won't be feeling so good. To happy people, this is okay. It's the way of things. They accept the inevitability of passing feelings. So, when they are feeling depressed, angry, or stressed out, they relate to these feelings with the same openness and wisdom. Rather than fight their feelings and panic simply because they are feeling bad, they accept their feelings, knowing that this too shall pass. Rather than stumbling and fighting against their negative feelings, they are graceful in their acceptance of them. This allows them to come gently and gracefully out of negative feeling states into more positive states of mind. One of the happiest people I know is someone who also gets quite low from time to time. The difference, it seems, is that he has become comfortable with his low moods. It's almost as though he doesn't really care because he knows that, in due time, he will be happy again. To him, it's no big deal. The next time you're feeling bad, rather than fight it, try to relax. See if, instead of panicking, you can be graceful and calm. Know that if you don't fight your negative feelings, if you are graceful, they will pass away just as surely as the sun sets in the evening.
Become a less aggressive driver.
Where do you get the most uptight? If you're like most people, driving in traffic is probably high on your list. To look at most major freeways these days, you'd think you're on a racetrack instead of a roadway. There are three excellent reasons for becoming a less aggressive driver. First, when you are aggressive, you put yourself and everyone around you in extreme danger. Second, driving aggressively is extremely stressful. Your blood pressure goes up, your grip on the wheel tightens, your eyes are strained, and your thoughts are spinning out of control. Finally, you end up saving no time in getting to where you want to go. Recently, I was driving south from Oakland to San Jose. Traffic was heavy, but moving. I noticed an extremely aggressive and angry driver weaving in and out of the lanes, speeding up and slowing down. Clearly, he was in a hurry. For the most part, I remained in the same lane for the entire 40-mile journey. I was listening to a new audio tape I had just purchased and daydreaming along the way. I enjoyed the trip a great deal because driving gives me a chance to be alone. As I was exiting off the freeway, the aggressive driver came up from behind me and raced on by. Without realizing it, I had actually arrived in San Jose ahead of him. All of his weaving, rapid acceleration, and putting families at risk had earned him nothing except perhaps some high blood pressure and a great deal of wear and tear on his vehicle. On average, he and I had driven at the same speed. The same principle applies when you see drivers speeding past you so they can beat you up to the next stoplight. It simply doesn't pay to speed. This is especially true if you get a ticket and have to spend 8 hours in traffic school. It will take you years of dangerous speeding to make up this time alone. When you make the conscious decision to become a less aggressive driver, you begin using your time in the car to relax. Try to see your driving not only as a way of getting you somewhere, but as a chance to breathe and to reflect. Rather than tensing your muscles, see if you can relax them instead. I even have a few audio tapes that are specifically geared toward muscular relaxation. Sometimes I pop one in and listen. By the time I reach my destination, I feel more relaxed than I did before getting into the car. During the course of your lifetime, you're probably going to spend a great deal of time driving. You can spend those moments being frustrated, or you can use them wisely. If you do the latter, you'll be a more relaxed person.
Think of what you have instead of what you want.
In over a dozen years as a stress consultant, one of the most pervasive and destructive mental tendencies I've seen is that of focusing on what we want instead of what we have. It doesn't seem to make any difference how much we have. We just keep expanding our list of desires, which guarantees we will remain dissatisfied. The mindset that says, "I'll be happy when this desire is fulfilled," is the same mindset that will repeat itself once that desire is met. A friend of ours closed escrow on his new home on a Sunday. The very next time we saw him, he was talking about his next house that was going to be even bigger. He isn't alone. Most of us do the very same thing. We want this or that. If we don't get what we want, we keep thinking about all that we don't have, and we remain dissatisfied. If we do get what we want, we simply recreate the same thinking in our new circumstances. So, despite getting what we want, we still remain unhappy. Happiness can't be found when we are yearning for new desires. Luckily, there is a way to be happy. It involves changing the emphasis of our thinking from what we want to what we have. Rather than wishing your spouse were different, try thinking about her wonderful qualities. Instead of complaining about your salary, be grateful that you have a job. Rather than wishing you were able to take a vacation to Hawaii, think of how much fun you have close to home. The list of possibilities is endless. Each time you notice yourself falling into the "I wish life were different" trap, back off and start over. Take a breath and remember all that you have to be grateful for. When you focus not on what you want, but on what you have, you end up getting more of what you want anyway. If you focus on the good qualities of your spouse, she'll be more loving. If you are grateful for your job, rather than complaining about it, you'll probably do a better job, be more productive, and end up getting a raise anyway. If you focus on ways to enjoy yourself around home, rather than waiting to enjoy yourself in Hawaii, you'll end up having more fun. If you ever do get to Hawaii, you'll be in the habit of enjoying yourself. And if by some chance you don't, you'll have a great life anyway. Make a note to yourself to start thinking more about what you have than what you want. If you do, your life will start appearing much better than before. For perhaps the first time in your life, you'll know what it means to feel satisfied.
Remember that you become what you practice most.
Repeated practice is one of the most basic principles of most spiritual and meditative paths. In other words, whatever you practice most is what you will become. If you are in the habit of being uptight whenever life isn't quite right, repeatedly reacting to criticism by defending yourself, insisting on being right, allowing your thinking to snowball in response to adversity, or acting like life is an emergency, then, unfortunately, your life will be a reflection of this type of practice. You will be frustrated because, in a sense, you have practiced being frustrated. Likewise, however, you can choose to bring forth in yourself qualities of compassion, patience, kindness, humility, and peace, again, through what you practice. I guess it's safe to say that practice makes perfect. It makes sense, then, to be careful what you practice. This isn't to suggest that you make your entire life into a great big project where the goal is to be constantly improving yourself, only that it's immensely helpful to become conscious of your own habits, both internal and external. Where is your attention? How do you spend your time? Are you cultivating habits that are helpful to your stated goals? Is what you say you want your life to stand for consistent with what your life really stands for? Simply asking yourself these and other important questions and answering them honestly helps to determine which strategies will be most useful to you. Have you always said to yourself, "I'd like to spend more time by myself," or "I've always wanted to learn to meditate," yet somehow you've never found the time? Sadly, many people spend far more time washing their car or watching reruns of television shows they don't even enjoy than they do making time for aspects of life that truly nurture their hearts. If you remember that what you practice, you will become, you may begin choosing different types of practice.
Do a favor and don't ask for or expect one in return.
This is a strategy that can help you practice integrating service into your life. It will show you how easy it is and how good it feels to do something nice for someone without expecting anything in return. So often, either consciously or unconsciously, we want something from others, especially when we have done something for them. "I cleaned the bathroom, she should clean the kitchen." Or, "I took care of her child last week, she should offer this week." It's almost as though we keep score of our own good deeds rather than remembering that giving is its own reward. When you do something nice for someone just to do it, you'll notice, if you're quiet enough inside yourself, a beautiful feeling of ease and peace. Just as vigorous exercise releases endorphins in your brain that make you feel good physically, your acts of loving kindness release the emotional equivalent. Your reward is the feeling you receive in knowing that you participated in an act of kindness. You don't need something in return or even a thank you. In fact, you don't even need to let the person know what you have done. What interferes with this peaceful feeling is our expectation of reciprocity. Our own thoughts interfere with our peaceful feelings as they clutter our minds, as we get caught up in what we think we want or need. The solution is to notice your "I want something in return" thoughts and gently dismiss them. In the absence of these thoughts, your positive feelings will return. See if you can think of something really thoughtful to do for someone and don't expect anything in return. Whether it's surprising your spouse with a clean garage or organized desk, mowing your neighbor's lawn, or coming home early from work to give your spouse a break from the kids. When you complete your favor, see if you can tap into the warm feeling of knowing you have done something really nice without expecting anything from the person you have just helped. If you practice, I think you'll discover that the feelings themselves are reward enough.
Get comfortable with not knowing.
There once was a village that had among its people a very wise old man. The villagers trusted this man to provide them answers to their questions and concerns. One day, a farmer from the village went to the wise man and said in a frantic tone, "Wise man, help me! A horrible thing has happened. My ox has died and I have no animal to help me plow my field. Isn't this the worst thing that could have possibly happened?" The wise old man replied, "Maybe so, maybe not." The man hurried back to the village and reported to his neighbors that the wise man had gone mad. Surely this was the worst thing that could have happened. Why couldn't he see this? The very next day, however, a strong young horse was seen near the man's farm. Because the man had no ox to rely on, he had the idea to catch the horse to replace his ox, and he did. How joyful the farmer was! Plowing the field had never been easier. He went back to the wise man to apologize. "You were right, wise man. Losing my ox wasn't the worst thing that could have happened. It was a blessing in disguise. I never would have captured my new horse had that not happened. You must agree that this is the best thing that could have happened." The wise man replied once again, "Maybe so, maybe not." Not again, thought the farmer. Surely the wise man had gone mad now. But once again, the farmer did not know what was to happen. A few days later, the farmer's son was riding the horse and was thrown off. He broke his leg and would not be able to help with the crop. "Oh no," thought the man, "now we will starve to death." Once again, the farmer went to the wise man. This time he said, "How did you know that capturing my horse was not a good thing? You were right again. My son is injured and won't be able to help with the crop. This time I'm sure that this is the worst thing that could have happened. You must agree this time." But, just as he had done before, the wise man calmly looked at the farmer and in a compassionate tone replied once again, "Maybe so, maybe not." Enraged that the wise man could be so ignorant, the farmer stormed back to the village. The next day, troops arrived to take every able-bodied man to the war that had just broken out. The farmer's son was the only young man in the village who didn't have to go. He would live while the others would surely die. The moral of this story provides a powerful lesson. The truth is, we don't know what's going to happen. We just think we do. Often, we make a big deal out of something. We blow up scenarios in our mind about all the terrible things that are going to happen. Most of the time, we are wrong. If we keep our cool and stay open to possibilities, we can be reasonably certain that eventually, all will be well. Remember, maybe so, maybe not.
Cut yourself some slack.
Each of the strategies in this audiobook is geared toward helping you become more relaxed, peaceful, and loving. One of the most important pieces of this puzzle, however, is to remember that your goal is to stay relaxed, to not get too worked up or concerned about how you are doing. Practice the strategies, keep them in mind, yet don't worry about being perfect. Cut yourself some slack. There will be many times when you lose it, when you revert to being uptight, frustrated, stressed, and reactive. Get used to it. When you do, it's okay. Life is a process, just one thing after another. When you lose it, just start again. One of the most common mistakes I see when people are attempting to become more inwardly peaceful is that they become frustrated by little setbacks. An alternative is to see your mistakes as learning opportunities, ways to navigate your growth and perspective. Say to yourself, whoops, I lost it again. Oh well, next time I'll handle it differently. Over time, you'll notice drastic changes in your responses to life, but it won't happen all at once. I once heard of a proposed book title that sums up the message of this strategy. I'm not okay, and you're not okay, and that's okay. Give yourself a break. No one is going to bat 100% or even close to it. All that's important is that, generally speaking, you are doing your best and that you are moving in the right direction. When you can learn to keep your perspective and to stay loving toward yourself, even when you prove you are human, you'll be well on your way to a happier life.
Become an early riser.
I have seen this simple, practical strategy help many people discover a more peaceful, even a more meaningful life. So many people wake up, rush to get ready, grab a cup of coffee, and charge out the door to work. After working all day, they return home tired. The same is usually true for men and women who stay home with their children. They get up just in time to start doing things for the kids. There is virtually no time for anything else. Whether you work, raise a family, or both, for the most part, you are too tired to enjoy any time left for you. As a solution to the tiredness, the assumption is often made, I better get as much sleep as I can. So, your free time is spent sleeping. For many people, this creates a deep longing in the heart. Surely there must be more to life than work, children, and sleep. Another way of looking at your fatigue is to consider that a lack of fulfillment and a sense of being overwhelmed both contribute to your tiredness. And, contrary to popular logic, a little less sleep and a little more time for you might be just what you need to combat your sense of fatigue. An hour or two that is reserved just for you before your day begins is an incredible way to improve your life. I usually get up between 3 and 4 in the morning. After a quiet cup of coffee, I usually spend some time doing yoga and a few minutes of meditation. After that, I will usually go upstairs and write for a while, but I also have time to read a chapter or two in whatever book I'm enjoying. Sometimes I'll just sit for a few minutes and do nothing. Virtually every day I stop whatever I'm doing to enjoy the sunrise as it comes up over the mountain. The phone never rings, no one is asking me to do anything for them, and there is nothing I absolutely have to do. It's by far the most quiet time of the day. By the time my wife and children wake up, I feel as though I've had a full day of enjoyment. No matter how busy I am that day, or whatever demands there are in my time, I know I've had my time. I never feel ripped off, as so many people unfortunately do, as if my life isn't my own. I believe this makes me more available for my wife and children, as well as my clients at work and other people who depend on me. Many people have told me that this one shift in their routine was the single most important change they have ever made in their lives. For the first time ever, they were able to participate in those quiet activities they never found the time to do. All of a sudden, the books are getting read, the meditation gets done, the sunrise is appreciated. The fulfillment you experience more than makes up for any lack of sleep you miss out on. If you must, turn off the television at night and get to sleep an hour or two earlier.
When trying to be helpful, focus on little things.
Mother Teresa once said, "We cannot do great things on this earth. We can only do little things with great love." Sometimes our grandiose plans to do great things at some later time interfere with our chances to do little things right now. A friend once told me, "I want my life to be about service, but I can't do anything yet. Someday, when I'm really successful, I'll do lots of things for others." Meanwhile, there are hungry people in the streets, elderly people who could use some company, mothers who need help with their children, people who can't read, neighbors whose homes need paint, streets with litter, people who need to be listened to, and thousands of other little things that need to be done. Mother Teresa was right. We can't change the world, but to make the world a brighter place, we don't need to. All we really have to do is focus on those little acts of kindness, things we can do right now. My favorite ways to be of service are to develop my own helping rituals and to practice random acts of kindness, almost always little things that give me enormous satisfaction and peace of mind. Often the most appreciated acts of kindness aren't the million-dollar grants from giant corporations, but the 1 hour of volunteer work in a home for the elderly or the $5 gift from someone who can't afford anything at all. If we focus on how little difference our acts of kindness really make in the scheme of things, surely we will end up frustrated and will probably use our hopelessness as an excuse to do nothing. If, however, we take great care in doing something, anything, we will feel the joy of giving and will help to make our world just a little bit brighter.
Remember, 100 years from now, all new people.
My good friend Patty recently shared this bit of wisdom with me that she learned from one of her favorite authors. It has added a great deal of perspective to my life. In the scheme of things, 100 years isn't all that long a time. However, one thing's for sure, 100 years from now we will all be gone from this planet. And when kept in mind, this idea can fill us with needed perspective during times of perceived crisis or stress. If you have a flat tire or lock yourself out of the house, what's it going to mean 100 years from now? How about if someone acted unkindly toward you, or if you had to stay up for most of the night working? What if your house didn't get cleaned up, or your computer breaks down? Suppose you can't afford to go on a much-needed vacation, buy a new car, or move to a larger apartment. All of these things, and most others, are brought into a deeper perspective when looked at with a 100-year view. Just this morning, I found myself at a mental fork in the road, about to get uptight about a mini-crisis at work. There was a double booking, and two people showed up at the same time for the same appointment. What saved me from getting overly stressed and too uptight was remembering that 100 years from now, no one will remember this moment. No one will care. I calmly took responsibility for the error, and one of the people was happy to reschedule. As usual, this was small stuff that could easily have been turned into big stuff.
Nurture a plant.
At first glance, this may seem like a strange or superficial suggestion. What good could it possibly do to nurture a plant? One of the goals of spiritual life, and one of the requirements of inner peace, is to learn to love unconditionally. The problem is, it's really hard to love a person, any person, unconditionally. The person we are trying to love inevitably says or does the wrong thing, or fails to meet our expectations in some way. So, we get upset and put conditions on our love. I'll love you, but you have to change. You must act the way I want you to act. Some people are better at loving their pets than the people in their lives. But to love a pet unconditionally is hard, too. What happens when your dog wakes you up with unnecessary barking in the middle of the night or ruins your favorite carpet with an accident? Do you love him just as much? My children have a bunny. It was really hard to love that bunny when he chewed a hole in my beautifully crafted wooden gate. A plant, however, is easy to love just the way it is. Therefore, nurturing a plant offers us an excellent opportunity to practice unconditional love. Why does virtually every spiritual tradition advocate unconditional love? Because love has such transformational power. Unconditional love brings forth peaceful feelings in both the giver and the receiver. Select a plant, indoor or outdoor, that you will see every day. Practice taking care of and loving that plant as if it were your baby. It's easier to care for your plant than your baby. No sleepless nights, no diapers, no crying. Talk to your plant. Tell it how much you love it. Love your plant whether it blooms or not, whether it lives or dies. Just love it. Notice how you feel as you offer this plant your unconditional love. When you offer this type of love, you're never agitated, irritated, or hurried. You're simply in a loving space. Practice this type of love each time you see your plant, at least once a day. After a short while, you'll be able to extend your loving-kindness beyond your plant as well. As you notice how good it feels to love, see if you can offer a similar love to the people in your life. Practice not needing them to change or be different to receive your love. Love them just the way they are. Your plant can be a wonderful teacher, showing you the power of love.
Redefine a meaningful accomplishment.
Sometimes it's easy to get carried away with our so-called accomplishments. We spend our lifetimes collecting achievements, earning praise and recognition, and seeking approval. So much so that we lose sight of what is truly meaningful. If you ask the average person, as I have done many times, what is a meaningful accomplishment? The typical response will be things like achieving a long-term goal, earning lots of money, winning a game, getting a promotion, being the best, earning praise, and so forth. The emphasis is almost always on the external aspects of life, things that happen outside of ourselves. Certainly, there is nothing wrong with these types of accomplishments. They are a way of keeping score and improving our circumstances. They are not, however, the most important types of accomplishments if your primary goal is one of happiness and inner peace. Seeing your photograph in the local newspaper may be a nice thing to achieve, but isn't as meaningful as learning to stay centered in the face of adversity. Yet many people would point to their photo in the paper as being a great accomplishment, but wouldn't necessarily think of staying centered as an accomplishment at all. Where are our priorities? If being peaceful and loving are among your primary goals, then why not redefine your most meaningful accomplishments as being those that support and measure qualities such as kindness and happiness? I think of my most meaningful accomplishments as stemming from inside myself. Was I kind to myself and others? Did I overreact to a challenge, or was I calm and collected? Am I happy? Did I hold on to anger, or was I able to let go and move on? Was I too stubborn? Did I forgive? These questions, and others like them, remind us that the true measure of our success comes not from what we do, but from who we are and how much love we have in our hearts. Rather than being consumed exclusively with external accomplishments, try putting more emphasis on what's really important. When you redefine what it means to achieve a meaningful accomplishment, it helps you to stay on your path.
If someone throws you a ball, you don't have to catch it.
My best friend, Benjamin Shield, taught me this valuable lesson. Often, our inner struggles come from our tendency to jump on board someone else's problem. Someone throws you a concern, and you assume you must catch it and respond. For example, suppose you're really busy when a friend calls in a frantic tone and says, "My mother is driving me crazy. What should I do?" Rather than saying, "I'm really sorry, but I don't know what to suggest," you automatically catch the ball and try to solve the problem. Then later, you feel stressed or resentful that you are behind schedule and that everyone seems to be making demands on you. It's easy to lose sight of your willing participation in the dramas of your own life. Remembering that you don't have to catch the ball is a very effective way to reduce the stress in your life. When your friend calls, you can drop the ball, meaning you don't have to participate simply because he or she is attempting to lure you in. If you don't take the bait, the person will probably call someone else to see if they will become involved. This doesn't mean you never catch the ball, only that it's your choice to do so. Neither does this mean that you don't care about your friend, or that you're crass or unhelpful. Developing a more tranquil outlook on life requires that we know our own limits, and that we take responsibility for our part in the process. Most of us get balls thrown at us many times each day, at work, from our children, friends, neighbors, salespeople, even strangers. If I caught all the balls thrown in my direction, I would certainly go crazy, and I suspect that you would too. The key is to know when we're catching another ball so that we won't feel victimized, resentful, or overwhelmed. Even something terribly simple like answering your phone when you're really too busy to talk is a form of catching the ball. By answering the phone, you are willingly taking part in an interaction that you may not have the time, energy, or mindset for at the present time. By simply not answering the phone, you are taking responsibility for your own peace of mind. The same idea applies to being insulted or criticized. When someone throws an idea or comment in your direction, you can catch it and feel hurt, or you can drop it and go on with your day. The idea of not catching the ball simply because it's thrown to you is a powerful tool to explore. I hope you'll experiment with this one. You may find that you catch the ball a lot more than you think you do.
Fill your life with love.
I don't know anyone who doesn't want a life filled with love. In order for this to happen, the effort must start within us. Rather than waiting for other people to provide the love we desire, we must be a vision and a source of love. We must tap into our own loving kindness in order to set an example for others to follow suit. It has been said that the shortest distance between two points is an intention. This is certainly true with regard to a life filled with love. The starting point or foundation of a life filled with love is the desire and commitment to be a source of love. Our attitude, choices, acts of kindness, and willingness to be the first to reach out will take us toward this goal. The next time you find yourself frustrated at the lack of love in your own life, or at the lack of love in the world, try an experiment. Forget about the world and other people for a few minutes. Instead, look into your own heart. Can you become a source of greater love? Can you think loving thoughts for yourself and others? Can you extend these loving thoughts outward toward the rest of the world, even to people whom you don't feel deserve it? By opening your heart to the possibility of greater love, and by making yourself a source of love rather than getting love as a top priority, you will be taking an important step in getting the love you desire. You'll also discover something truly remarkable. The more love you give, the more you will receive. As you put more emphasis on being a loving person, which is something you can control, and less emphasis on receiving love, which is something you can't control, You'll find that you have plenty of love in your life. You'll soon discover one of the greatest secrets in the world. Love is its own reward.
Keep asking yourself, what's really important?
It's easy to get lost and overwhelmed in the chaos, responsibilities, and goals of life. Once overwhelmed, it's tempting to forget about and postpone that which is most near and dear to your heart. I found that it's helpful to keep asking myself, what's really important? As part of my early morning routine, I take a few seconds to ask myself this question. Reminding myself of what's really important helps me keep my priorities straight. It reminds me that, despite my multitude of responsibilities, I have a choice of what's most important in my life and where I put my greatest amount of energy. Being available for my wife and children, writing, practicing my inner work, and so forth. Despite the appearance of being overly simplistic, I have found this strategy to be immensely helpful in keeping me on track. When I take a few moments to remind myself of what's really important, I find that I'm more present moment oriented, in less of a hurry, and that being right loses its appeal. Conversely, when I forget to remind myself of what's really important, I find that I can quickly lose sight of my priorities and, once again, get lost in my own busyness. I'll rush out the door, work late, lose my patience, skip my exercise, and do other things that are in conflict with the goals of my life. If you regularly take a minute to check in with yourself, to ask yourself what's really important, you may find that some of the choices you are making are in conflict with your own stated goals. This strategy can help you align your actions with your goals and encourage you to make more conscious, loving decisions.
Mind your own business.
It's tough enough trying to create a life of serenity when dealing with your own mental tendencies, issues, real-life problems, habits, and the contradictions and complexities of life. But when you feel compelled to deal with other people's issues, your goal of becoming more peaceful becomes all but impossible. How often do you find yourself saying things like, I wouldn't do that if I were her, or I can't believe he did that, or what is she thinking about? How often are you frustrated, bothered, annoyed, or concerned about things that you not only cannot control or be of actual help with, but are also none of your business? This is not a prescription to avoid being of help to people. Rather, it's about knowing when to help and when to leave something alone. I used to be the type of person who would jump in and try and solve a problem without being asked. Not only did my efforts prove fruitless, they were also almost always unappreciated and sometimes even resented. Since recovering from my need to be overly involved, my life has become much simpler. And, now that I'm not butting in where I'm not wanted, I'm far more available to be of help when I am asked or truly needed. Minding your own business goes far beyond simply avoiding the temptation to try and solve other people's problems. It also includes eavesdropping, gossiping, talking behind other people's backs, and analyzing or trying to figure out other people. One of the major reasons most of us focus on the shortcomings or problems of others is to avoid looking at ourselves. When you catch yourself involved where you really don't belong, congratulate yourself for having the humility and wisdom to back off. In no time at all, you'll free up tons of extra energy to focus your attention where it's truly relevant or needed.
Look for the extraordinary in the ordinary.
I heard a story about two workers who were approached by a reporter. The reporter asked the first worker, "What are you doing?" His response was to complain that he was virtually a slave, an underpaid bricklayer who spent his days wasting his time placing bricks on top of one another. The reporter asked the second worker the same question. His response, however, was quite different. "I'm the luckiest person in the world," he said. "I get to be a part of important and beautiful pieces of architecture. I help turn single pieces of brick into exquisite masterpieces." They were both right. The truth is, we see in life what we want to see. If you search for ugliness, you'll find plenty of it. If you want to find fault with other people, your career, or the world in general, you'll certainly be able to do so. But the opposite is also true. If you look for the extraordinary in the ordinary, you can train yourself to see it. This bricklayer sees cathedrals within pieces of brick. The question is, can you? Can you see the extraordinary synchronicity that exists in our world? The perfection of the universe in action? The extraordinary beauty of nature? The incredible miracle of human life? To me, it's all a matter of intention. There is so much to be grateful for, so much to be in awe about. Life is precious and extraordinary. Put your attention on this fact, and little ordinary things will take on a whole new meaning.
Live this day as if it were your last. It might be.
When are you going to die? In 50 years? 20? 10? 5? Today? Last time I checked, no one had told me. I often wonder, when listening to the news, did the person who died in the auto accident on his way home from work remember to tell his family how much he loved them? Did he live well? Did he love well? Perhaps the only thing that is certain is that he still had things in his in-basket that weren't yet done. The truth is, none of us has any idea how long we have to live. Sadly, however, we act as if we're going to live forever. We postpone the things that, deep down, we know we want to do. Telling the people we love how much we care, spending time alone, visiting a good friend, taking that beautiful hike, running a marathon, writing a heartfelt letter, going fishing with your daughter, learning to meditate, becoming a better listener, and on and on. We come up with elaborate and sophisticated rationales to justify our actions and end up spending most of our time and energy doing things that aren't all that important. We argue for our limitations, and they become our limitations. I felt it appropriate to end this audiobook by suggesting to you that you live each day as if it were your last on this earth. I suggest this not as a prescription to be reckless or to abandon your responsibilities, but to remind you of how precious life really is. A friend of mine once said, "Life is too important to take too seriously." 10 years later, I know he was right. I hope that this audiobook has been, and will continue to be, helpful to you. Please don't forget the most basic strategy of all. Don't sweat the small stuff. I will end this audiobook by sincerely saying that I wish you well. Treasure yourself.
Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and It's All Small Stuff, was written and read by Richard Carlson, Ph.D. The director was Carol Shapiro. Editing and post-production by Rob Weisberg. The mix engineer was Jocelyn Gonzalez. Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and It's All Small Stuff, was produced by Florence Barreau Adams. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Richard Carlson's Don't Worry, Make Money.